Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Okay, I'm joined now by a rock star turned author, Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol. You're very welcome.
Oh, thank you, Brendan. Thanks for having me.
And Gary, people are thinking now, oh no, the rock star thought he had a book in him. But it turns out you actually had a great book in you. And I'll admit, right, I finished reading The Forest is the Path, as the book is called. I put it down and I promptly started crying for my father. And my father is dead over 2 years. I said this to my colleague and she said, so I'm in the middle of reading it and I'm crying for my father. So I think anyone who has a father is going to get this book. It's kind of a companion piece to last year's album of the same name, but it's very much about you and your dad and your journey. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about all that through the medium of five songs you've picked for us that mean a lot for you. So can we go back first? The picture you paint in the book, I think you were a sensitive kid, were you?
Yeah, that's an understatement, probably. Yeah. I don't think anybody's got it figured out when they're younger. I certainly didn't. I probably don't have it figured out now when I'm 48 or whatever. But I loved, you know, music from an early age. I think that was the thing that was always sort of an ever present in my life. You know, and I never thought I'd have a life in music, of course, at that age. But I always kind of hoped.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about your dad, Jack, when you were a kid. You have nice memories of him.
Yeah, he was, in my youth, he was more of a sort of a stoic figure. He's funny, a very funny man, but he wouldn't have given, you know, he wouldn't have been too emotional. I never saw him cry or anything like that. He was kind of a tough guy. Yeah, he wouldn't be running around telling people his feelings or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which probably would have been the opposite of me. I was more like my mum. But yeah, him and I were a bit sort of chalk and cheese, which, you know, as time rolled on, you know, that became more of an issue between the two of us. But at that age, I was just looking at him like he was the sort of giant godlike figure in my life.
Yeah. And then you mentioned about being into music. I think it was Nirvana and Seamus Heaney kind of changed your life at a particular point.
Yeah, Nirvana, when I was 16 years old, I heard Nevermind and it blew my mind completely. And then I heard Seamus Heaney, I think probably the year before. I think it was within a year span of my life that sort of it changed the trajectory of my life, because Seamus Heaney made me want to write, and Nirvana made me want to write songs and be in a band and be on stage. I saw Nirvana play in the King's Hall in Belfast in 1992, and it was a earth-shatteringly sort of cataclysmic moment in my life. That it was the beginning of everything, really, for me. I knew that that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, even if I had to have a proper job, you know, and do it at night time. I was going to be in music forever, you know.
Okay, so that brings us to your first choice today then. This is Nirvana, Come As You Are. That's Nirvana, Come As You Are, and that's Gary Lightbody's first music choice today. I can only imagine, Gary, being a kid in Northern Ireland and going and seeing Nirvana play and it just blowing the doors off everything. And a lot of bands didn't come to Northern Ireland even still back then, did they?
Yeah, no, I mean, I saw the Red Hot Chili Peppers were my first gig in 1991 in the Ulster Hall, and Nirvana came the following year. And they brought Teenage Fan Club and the Breeders with them, and it's still one of the best bills, rock bills I've ever seen. But very few international acts would come to Belfast in those days. So anybody that ever did we love them forever. You know what I mean? I've you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Nirvana, like they're just, they can do no wrong in my opinion, because their music is always sort of tattooed on my heart, because they came to Belfast at a time when no one else did, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They were there for you when they needed you. So at 18, then you left Bangor. You went to Dundee to university, where Snow Patrol started. I think you were running away from Northern Ireland then, were you?
I think I probably was at the time. My love of Northern Ireland partly came from being away and missing the place and returning to the place to live. And, you know, I'm deeply, deeply in love with Ireland, you know. But at that time in my life, yeah, I probably was running from things that I didn't understand. It was a place that the vibration for me was wrong. And Dundee felt like it was funny because 50% of my year were Irish from all over Ireland, from Northern Ireland, from the Republic of Ireland. 50% of my year were in Scotland, and half my year was literally the whole year, not just my class, were from Ireland. So it was kind of like being away from home, but also home was very present there as well.
Yeah, okay. And your next choice is from around then. It's Jeff Buckley and Last Goodbye. Why this?
They didn't have TVs in our dorm rooms or anything like that, but there was a TV in the TV room or whatever, the common room, and I would stay up late watching MTV, and there'd be nobody else there. One night, a video came on, and it was Jeff Buckley, and it was just one of those moments of hearing that voice for the first time. Still, I think, one of the greatest voices to have ever lived. And that album that Last Goodbye is from, Grace, is one of my favourite albums of all time.
Okay, here's Gary Lightbody's second choice, Jeff Buckley and Last Goodbye. Stunning, isn't it? That's Jeff Buckley and Last Goodbye, and that is Gary Lightbody's second music choice today. So, Gary, you were saying earlier about that you knew music was what you had to do when you saw Nirvana, whether you could make a life out of it or not. You guys had been plugging away for quite a while before Run became a hit, then Broke America with Chasing Cars. Is it hard to keep the faith in those years?
Yeah. They were a lot of fun those years, but they were also a slog, that was for sure. We would be going around entirely UK and Ireland tours, not really playing anywhere else. We played New York one time in the late 90s. We played Amsterdam a couple of times, but it was pretty much exclusively the same kind of places again and again. And we were playing to, you know, maybe 20 people a night. And our battered van that we called the Vengabus had a hole in the floor, like the Flintstones car. And, you know, we would sleep on the back of the gear at night, or towards the end of those 10 years, you know, I was sleeping on friends' couches in Glasgow or in their spare room sometimes and things like that. So it's like, yeah, it was a bit of a slog, but at the same time, we were getting to do what we loved doing. There was no money, but there was still plenty of fun and plenty of music, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can hear a nostalgia in you for those days. It's funny, I think a lot of bands, when they're really successful, look back on those early days very fondly, don't they? So tell me about your next choice, which is a stone-cold classic, Marlena Shaw and California Soul.
Well, I suppose that was another kind of Dundee moment where I didn't know anything about dance music until I was 19. Nothing about hip-hop or soul music. I was only exclusively listening to rock music and indie music. And then I went to this club in Dundee called Deep End. It was playing deep house and house music, and I just fell in love with the music, and I danced all night. And at the very last song, when the lights came on, instead of finishing with another house kind of banger, they finished with that song, Marlena Shaw, California Soul. And I think my mind exploded. I mean, it just literally, I'd never heard anything like it. And I just, you know, I had no context to put it in. It just felt like the heavens opening and, you know, just being bathed in light. And then I went over to the DJ and said, what's that song? And I'd been dancing. My friends had left hours ago. I'd been dancing on my own all night. The DJ went, we've been watching you all night. And he went, do you want to hang out with us? And that DJ happened to be Tom Simpson, who ended up in Snow Patrol for 17 years. Wow. So it was kind of that moment. Like I went off with them, Tom and Nick DeCosmo, who ended up as the editor of Mixmag, and Roy Kerr, who ended up as the freelance Hellraiser and produced London Grammar and loads of great bands. So that kind of group, I kind of became their DJ box carrier. You know, I would carry the records for them and go around, and they would kind of teach me how to DJ and teach me about dance music and hip hop and soul music. And it was like an education. It was like it was a different landscape and a different universe, and a universe that I still adore to this day.
Ah, that's a brilliant story. Okay, so here's the song that opened it all up for Gary Lightbody. Prepare to have your mind blown, Marlena Shaw, California Soul. Marlena Shaw, California Soul, and that's Gary Lightbody's third choice today. That's one of those examples of when everything just came together exactly right in a recording studio, isn't it? It's incredible.
It's one of those just moments of just sublime genius. Can I tell another story about Marlena Shaw? Actually?
Yeah.
Marlene obviously is not with us anymore, sadly, but a few years back, it was my birthday and we were playing in Vegas and we did the sound check and everyone was being a wee bit weird. And I was like, something weird's happening. I thought I was maybe going to get the bumps or something like that. I don't know. Like, you know, like you've got something weird is happening and you can't quite put your finger on. And then our tour manager went, Gary, after soundcheck, Gary, can you come in? I was like, okay. And opened the dressing room door, and sitting in our dressing room was Marlena Shaw.
Wow.
And I sat with her for 2 hours and we talked about her career and I just asked her everything, and she was just so delightful and amazing and just full of joy and wonder, and that was one of my best birthdays ever.
I can imagine, yeah. And the fact that she didn't disappoint, amazing.
Oh, she was just an absolute delight and incredible.
So listen, you had your own kind of California soul years then. You were living the rock star life in LA, but I think ultimately the drinking drugs got a bit out of hand for you, did it?
Yeah, very much so. My dad, bless him, it all comes back to him, I guess. He used to say, never drink alone, son, never drink alone. That was one of his catchphrases. And I always took it to heart until I didn't take it to heart. I forgot what he said.
Yeah.
At one point in my life. And that's when things kind of did get off the rails a wee bit. And I was in a bar in Santa Monica where I lived over there. And this was the nadir. where I was, you know, I don't know, it was 6 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever. It was still daylight. And I was sitting on my own drinking. And this couple, I only saw this out of my peripheral vision, but I didn't look over anything at any point. But this couple sat down at the table beside me. And I saw them both turn and look at me and look at the state of me. And they both silently, they didn't say anything. They just both took their drinks, stood up and walked to the other side of the room. And for whatever reason, that just got through to me. I was like, you look a sight, light body, get your life together. There was a few people in my life that really helped me get sober. I wouldn't have been able to get through it without them. And, you know, I haven't looked back, you know. I haven't had a drink in eight and a half years, or drugs for that matter, you know, so neither of them. So it has changed my life dramatically, and it has made the days so much brighter.
Yeah. You talk about the people who helped you. I gather early sobriety isn't for the faint-hearted. What was it? Your friend, the producer, Jack Knife Lee, when you told him you were getting sober, what did he say to you?
He said, give me a call. And that, well, obviously I called him more than, you know, more than just like once in 9 months. But he said, you're going to want to speak to somebody in 9 months. And I was like, okay. And I think it was around about 9 months, certainly between 6 and 9 months, I started to feel this extraordinary, like all the demons that, you know, for whatever reason that you drink, and it's not just because we love the drink, it's just something, someone else. Yeah. And we're trying to drown those things, you know. And when there's no drink to drown them in, they tend to rear up like monsters in your head. And that's when they all started coming back up. You know, I think what I thought was stop drinking. There you go. I've done it.
Yeah.
I'm fixed. It's a longer, much longer road than that.
Yeah. I think this brings us to your next music choice, does it? Frank Ocean, Pink and White.
Yeah. Yeah. That song simply saved my life.
Really?
Yeah. There's a few songs that have done that for me, but that one is one of the most important songs. I don't know lyrically that it was the lyrics that were resonating with me as much as the song was vibrating at exactly the right frequency for me, because I just played it over and over and over and over again to the point where most people would actually, it would probably send most people mad to listen to a song 1,000 times. But I just kept playing it over and over again, and I gradually found my way out of the hole that I was in. And I'm absolutely certain that it was the rope that pulled me out of it.
Wow. Okay. So here it is, Gary Lightbody's fourth choice, Frank Ocean, Pink and White.
Just the same way you showed me you were sure. If you could die and come back to life, up for air from the swimming pool, you'd kneel down to the dry land, kiss the earth that birthed you, gave you tools just to stay alive and make it up when the sun is ruined. That's the same way you showed me, showed you, showed me love. Glory from above, regardless, dear, it's all downhill from here.
Frank Ocean, Pink and White, and that's the song that saved Gary Lightbody's life. But before we get back to your dad, the book is about other things as well, I think. I think home is one of the kind of themes you explore in there. When and why did you decide to move back home to Bangor?
Well, I've always had the house that I'm standing in right now, I've had for 20 years here. So this has always been my home here, but I've spent a lot of time away as well. About 4 years ago, I decided just to stay here, you know, this to be the only place I lived. And I might decide to go and live somewhere else at some point. But, you know, I love the place so much. I'm looking out the Belfast Lough right now. I swim in there every day. I walk the coastal path every day that I'm home. And my family are nearby and my friends. It's a beautiful place to live.
Yeah, it sounds like life is simple now, is it? As against chaotic.
Yeah, it's very simple and I love it that way.
Yeah. Okay, listen, this is a heavy question, but you do talk about it in the book that you haven't been in a relationship for 10 years. And like you're harsh on yourself. You say you're too scared to love someone else or let them love you. Too many years battering myself from the inside to love much of anything I find in there. And you say I've pushed away all the love I was ever offered. That's rough, is it?
Yeah, hearing it read back to me there it feels rough. But I'm talking about a version of myself that I'm hoping I'm growing out of, you know. Every day I try to learn something. Every day I start the day by saying, I know nothing. Please let today teach me something. I think that I'm growing into a person that is full of love for my friends and my family and open to the idea of love in a relationship. And I'm not closed off to love anymore, but I have been. So I can't not tell that. I want to be honest. You know, I just want to be honest. I can't not tell the story of how I was.
Why do you think you pushed away all the love you were ever offered?
I was so cowardly. I just didn't know how to be in a relationship, I don't think. I think music was always my first priority, the band and the albums and the touring. And it didn't leave that much space for other people in the way that I really wished I had have given, because there's some extraordinary women I've been in my life, and I wish I'd realized it at the time that I should have given them more time. But I think I was pretty single-minded in my approach to music. That just took over my whole life, and I think I'm better at prioritizing lots of different things in my life now. I think myself, Johnny, and Nathan are better at prioritizing different things in our lives now, and relationships and music and making music with other people as well as Snow Patrol. And I'd like to write another book, and I'd like to spend more time with my family and my friends. And I think I understand now that life is not just about the pursuit of one thing. And for me, that was always music, but it can be the love of so many things.
Yeah. And I think you have a certain amount of guilt around your dad, don't you? Which I think, look, we all have it in various ways. When did your dad get Alzheimer's?
Well, I'm laughing because trying to get him to the doctor was a five-year ordeal itself, yeah. You know. But so it was probably, we'd say that we were seeing signs of it, and my sister and my mom were seeing signs of it before I was, because I was away so much. And I didn't want to believe them when they were telling me. But there's probably 8 years before he passed. It was a long, long time.
Yeah. And I think you feel a bit guilty about that time and about the run-up to his death and that, do you?
I feel guilty. I think the most guilt I feel is about the arguments that we had over so many years.
Yeah.
I wasn't arguing with him in the Alzheimer's years. That was our arguments were long gone, but before his mind started to fade a little and then a lot. But I did argue with him from I was 16 to I was way too old to be arguing with my dad, like 35, something like that. And we were still arguing the bit out about everything, politics mostly. And now I realize it was such a waste of time. Because we also had lots of moments of levity, and my dad was hilarious, you know, like he made me laugh all the time. But it just took one thing, like one, you know, you veer slightly into a topic that was in sort of dangerous waters and that it would go off the rails. You know, also my mom would end up kind of being sort of referee, and what a waste of energy and time it was to have so much anger. When I finally just was like, I'm not arguing with my dad anymore. When I finally realized, way too late, as I say, you realize that the things that we fight about, they're mostly unnecessary, especially with the people that we love, because you can't get that time back. And I think about it all the time.
Yeah. You end the book by saying sorry to your dad and you say, you are my father and I love you. Did you never get to say that to him really when he was still alive?
I said that many times.
Yeah.
He never said it to me. He didn't know how. He said it in action. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I was under, you know, you hear stories, heartbreaking stories of, you know, fathers that never told their sons or daughters that they love them. And their sons and daughters didn't know if their father did. I knew my dad did. I was lucky in that way. I might never have heard the words, but I did know that he did because he showed up. He just showed up. If you needed him, he was there.
Yeah.
That's how you knew. And I could see sometimes when sort of Snow Patrol finally took off and there was events where he was standing side of stage at Marley Park and I brought him onto the stage. And years ago now, the whole crowd cheered him and then he walked back onto the stage. And then when I looked back over at him, I could see tears in his eyes, which is rare for him. So I knew he loved me and, yeah. and I'm glad for that. And we also had a lot of good times and good memories as well as some of the things that I feel guilt about. You know?
Yeah, and he was proud of you as well, obviously. Would you mind telling that lovely story about, I know that you toured a lot with U2 in the early years particularly, and I know you have huge regard for them. Would you tell that lovely story about your dad and Bono?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. It was his favourite story, so I'm delighted to pass it on. So yeah, so we do a show every now and again. It's not a sort of a fixed festival, but we do a show in my hometown of Bangor in Ward Park. The third one of those was my dad's last ever Snow Patrol gig. He passed away 6 months after it. I'd texted Bono about couple of months earlier to see if he'd like to guest on a song with us. We wanted to play U2 One, and I asked him if he'd like to come and guest on his own song. And he said, I am busy that day, but let me see if I can move a few things around. So this is the type, this is the things that people don't see. Bono had a bunch of meetings that day, and he moved them all from wherever they were in the world to Belfast. He got people to come to meet him in Belfast so that he could come and do our show that night, which is amazing, absolutely amazing. He moved his whole life around for me and Johnny and Nathan and Johnny Quinn and Paul Wilson at the time, who were still in the band. So Bono was going to be arriving about 10 minutes before he was coming on stage, so it was halfway through the show. And when he arrived, he was standing beside somebody that works for us, Natalie. He leaned over to Natalie and said, who's that gentleman in the wheelchair? Is that Gary's dad? And she said, yes. And he went immediately over to my dad, sitting in a wheelchair watching us, and chatted to my dad for 10 minutes and took pictures with him, was tapped on the shoulder to say, that's you on stage now, Bono. And he shook my dad's hand, said, lovely to meet you, and walked onto this stage and sung One with us. And for the rest of my dad's life, anybody that would listen would get that story about my dad, Jack, and Bono being the best of friends. He loved that story, and we all loved that story too.
Ah, stop. That's a lovely story. The book then is framed kind of around the days around your dad's death and then a year later. You were, you know, they say grief takes a year and a day to process fully. You had a kind of a year of numbness, Gary, after his death before something kind of unlocked for you then, did it?
Yeah, I was watching a TV show and I saw a poem by Rumi came up at the end of the show and I just bawled my eyes out. You know when the Charlie Brown cartoons where the tears fly out of the eyes, like really high up? They didn't fly up in the air. They didn't defy gravity, obviously, but they poured out. I was standing behind my couch with my arms on the back of the couch. Like, it really did feel like a year's worth of tears that just poured out in that moment. It was mental. And then the next day, I mean, it took the wind out of me as well, because I think I fell asleep pretty much straight after it. It was exhausting. And then the next day I woke up and I hadn't written a song in a year either. And I wrote a song about him, which was at the time called The Long Shadow. Immediately after that song, I wrote another song that wasn't about him called These Lies, which is actually the first song written that ended up on The Forest is the Path. So it literally, the book kind of links everything together, like his death, and you kind of don't really, they don't seem like it's linked, the album and his death, but it is. It kind of was the, I think it was him nudging me onwards, really.
Get on with it, no sir.
Yeah. That sounds like something he would say.
So that, I presume, brings us to your final music choice. Tell me about Medium Build, Crying Over You. I didn't know this guy, and this is fantastic.
Yeah, he's brilliant. We were listening to him loads when we were making the album. I don't think his album was out yet, but he'd released, as artists do often these days, release a lot of singles before the album eventually comes. So there was a lot of songs on his, you know, streaming services. Mm. And we were listening to the song in question here, Crying Over You, and a bunch of other ones as well. I think he's originally from Alaska, but I think he ended up in LA. His voice is extraordinary. His songwriting is amazing. His lyrics are brilliant, really, really brilliant. And I think we were really inspired by him when we were making The Forest is the Path. And I wanted to kind of give him a shout out and by putting him on this, the list of five songs.
Okay. And yeah, we'll play it in a minute and I'm sure it'll bring him to a whole new audience. So there's a deluxe version of the album coming out as well with the book, six new tracks. You're currently on tour. You played Dublin and Belfast last week. How was that?
Amazing. We played the Three Arena first, and that was incredible. That was last Tuesday. Really brilliant. I just loved it. And then we played Belfast on Thursday again. Amazing. So many of the gigs on this tour, of this UK and Ireland tour, have been my favourite gigs in various cities. Like, we played Glasgow, and that was my favourite Glasgow gig. I don't know how many, we lived in Glasgow for 10 years. I don't know how many times we played Glasgow. It must be 50.
Yeah.
But, it was my favourite one. And then Manchester, another one, favourite. Dublin, it's up there with the Dublin. I mean, think about the amazing crowds, audiences we played to in Dublin. I mean, and then Belfast Thursday was amazing. And Johnny McDade had hurt his hand at the start of the tour. We were going from Switzerland to Frankfurt on a train. We did the whole European tour on the train. It was really fun, except for this thing that happened, where Johnny got his hand caught in a door, and it wrecked his hand. He ended up getting surgery on his hand. Never missed a show. And then the Thursday night in Belfast, at midnight or so, he fell and wrecked his other hand.
Oh my
smashed
God.
His knuckles on his other hand. When we came in for sound check on Friday, he couldn't move the fingers on his right hand. And he still played the show on Friday night. He has just today gone to get surgery on his hand. It's insane. He had two broken hands on that Friday show.
Yeah.
And he played the gig.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. He's made of different stuff from the rest of us. Like, absolutely.
Do you know what, Gary? Maybe you take it as a sign that you're a band on fire. No, you rejuvenated. The Forest is the Path is definitely, I think, one of your finest albums. You're only getting better. And the tour continues. You're all over America and Canada for the next while. You'll be back in Ireland playing Cork's Virgin Media Park on June 19th and Belfast's Ormo Park on June 21st. And the book, again, is called The Forest is the Path, as is the album, and they're both absolutely terrific. The book published by HarperCollins. Gary Lightbody, I hope that wasn't too hard on you. Thank you very much for your generosity and your openness. And you know what? I think so many people are going to get so much out of that. And I got so much out of your book as well. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Brendan. I really appreciate it. It was lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you. And we'll finish now on your final music choice. This is Medium Build, Crying Over You.
Always tried to be the quiet one, but you got a sneaky way of saying less than me. The boys are playing basketball, me and you trying to sink into the groove. Yeah, we could walk the reservoir, talk about the ways that we want to be loved. You're in me like a memory. I
just can't seem to let it go. Thought about crying over you, but I just turned on the TV.